Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. It's still Trump's America and week three and counting, if I'm counting correctly. So we'll be digging into what Trump's cabinet is shaping up to look like. Who are the nominees? He's appointed to a range of various important government agencies. We'll also be digging into what's at stake for people with disabilities under a Trump regime. But first, Jeremy Slevin returns with what's in the news. Jeremy.
Well, it's all Trump all the time these days.
It does feel that way.
Feels like that. So I guess we might as well talk about it. Let's talk about his tweets. Why don't we?
Because that could be a long conversation. We only have like maybe 10 more, 11 minutes.
Or let's do a meta conversation about whether we should talk about his tweets, because I have some feelings on that.
Can I actually suggest that we tweet about it instead?
Yeah.
And like just not. And so have like 9 more silent minutes, and it's just us tweeting back and forth.
You hear us typing
and
on
listeners
our phones.
Can just follow along, like the timeline with timestamps.
Exactly. We can schedule all these tweets in advance.
That might actually become like a trend that will actually be a thing in radio.
Yeah, that's tweeting is the future of radio.
I feel like I'm going to get in
trouble
for this. Sorry, Progressive Voices Network and WEACT Radio. But seriously, there's a lot that's being talked about right now. It isn't just how his cabinet's shaping up and his nominations. It's also like what should progressives and generally people who didn't vote for him and don't support him and don't really know what to do with him, what should we be doing? There's been a lot of let's not normalize him. Now there's a new strain of thought.
Right. Well, and I think this question is especially applicable for the media. This week, he's, of course, sent out a tweet saying people should have their citizenship revoked for burning the flag, saying he would have won the popular vote if not for illegal voters. I think he retweeted a 16-year-old and changed their tweet. This is now pretty typical for Donald Trump.
It's exactly what we saw throughout the campaign.
Right. And I think what we learned is that if we're talking about his tweets, he's winning. As long as we're just talking about the latest outlandish tweet, we're not talking about what he's actually going to be doing. And it's one thing when it's a campaign and the focus is all on who's winning the news cycle. But now he's actually appointing people to his cabinet. He's announcing his policy plans. And then 1 minute, he's tweeting about flag burning. The next minute, he's appointing a former partner at Goldman Sachs to be his Treasury Secretary. And I think it's pretty clear. Newt Gingrich yesterday was on Fox News and he said this is all intentional. He throws a rabbit out there knowing the media is going to chase the rabbit. And I think the key takeaway is, are we going to keep covering his tweets or are we going to start talking about his policy?
So do we potentially have the power to shut down chaos theory as a strategy if instead of following the shiny thing every time there's a shiny thing, we say we don't really care about the sideshow. We actually are going to focus all of our attention like a laser on the things that actually matter, like his policies.
Yeah. And I think if progressives can take any lesson from this election, I think that works better. I mean, 60-something percent of voters thought Trump was totally unqualified to be president. And
including a lot of the people who voted for him.
20% of those people still voted for him. So we can attack his character and his temperament all we want. But as long as some people still think, oh, well, he's going to fight for us in the end, he's going to win.
So devil's advocate, though, right? So what you've just articulated is the case for normalizing Trump, and that there's a lot at stake if we don't do that, because the sideshow is going to take over and keep center stage. But on the flip side, right, isn't there a real argument to be made for if we do normalize him, if we do allow somebody who behaves as outlandishly and inappropriately as he does to take and hold and be inaugurated to the highest office in the land, doesn't that change and dilute and really fundamentally alter what that office means forever?
I guess the short answer is it's too late.
He hasn't been inaugurated yet. Just going to say
it's almost too late.
Jill Stein still has a recount going.
Right. There's always hope in Stein. I think he's going to be president, and we have a choice. Do we want him to be able to get through an agenda that cuts Medicare for millions of people, that slashes Head Start and every safety net program, that gives $10 trillion in tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans, while he's busy tweeting about whatever he wants to tweet to get the media chasing rabbit? Or do we want to stay laser focused on stopping his agenda? That's not to say that we shouldn't focus on the norms of the presidency and our Constitution, but I think so far the scale has been tilted so far in the other direction, and it needs some balancing.
Well, and you started to talk about some of the programs that are under attack. Medicare is absolutely front and center in that. But we're starting to see now glimmers of how a Republican-controlled Congress with a President Donald Trump are planning to go after some of those programs.
Yes.
What do we know now about how they're planning to massively exacerbate poverty and inequality, Jeremy?
This is a perfect transition to talk about what we said we wanted to talk about.
Are you accusing me of being a brilliant segue architect? That's right. I am. Guilty as charged.
A couple days before Tom Price was named the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
And of course, Tom Price being the budget chair.
Right. That's his current job. And before he got this post in the Trump administration last week, he said, we're going to put forward two reconciliation bills. And reconciliation bills means it can pass with 50 votes in the Senate, meaning they don't need any Democrats. They can pass it without having to overcome a filibuster. It's just a simple majority, meaning only Republicans.
And of course, this is part of the budget process.
Right, right. And he was budget chair, and he said they want to do two reconciliation bills. The first one will likely include repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Who knows if it will include replacement? Who knows if it will undo Medicaid expansion? But that's what they've said so far. And the second one would be even broader. And Tom Price said they want to include voucherization of Medicare in that, which would essentially privatize Medicare and jack up costs for millions of seniors. And that's not all that's on the table. Ryan has said he would like to push through his poverty agenda as part of these reconciliation bills. And that would, of course, could include everything from food stamps to Head Start to Pell Grants to combining dozens of programs into a single block grant to the states, which would decline in value over time. So that's the lay of the land in a nutshell.
Oh, I'm laughing because I don't know what else to do.
Yep.
Besides laugh, because you'd cry your eyes out if you didn't, right? And we will be spending plenty of time on air crying in the months ahead, I'm sure. But so basically what you've just sketched out is one sort of fake budget process that is all about repealing the Affordable Care Act so that 22 million Americans no longer have health insurance.
Correct.
And then a second budget process, which is about undoing the entire safety net and social insurance system, and in a way where, because of the way the rules of the House and Senate work, Republicans will effectively be able to ram the agenda through without any Democratic support.
Correct. Although, on the bright side, it makes our goal pretty clear, because now we're only focused on the few Republican swing senators. Because if you remember back to the original Affordable Care Act, it was also passed through reconciliation. So it was clear that we are focused on the few Democratic senators who are the swing votes who can get us to 50 votes. And so now we're focused on people like Chuck Grassley or Olympia Snow, Republicans who may not support such a radical agenda like repealing health care for their constituents or block granting SNAP for their constituents.
So I want to then merge these two conversations, right?
Yeah.
So this is the road ahead. This is what we're up against. Literally everything on the chopping block, including school lunch for kids, which has long been a sacred cow that nobody on left or right would touch. But Speaker Paul Ryan has called for slashing. That was part of his agenda released earlier this year. So everything on the hit list, really nothing has been spared. But we're also having this conversation about about, okay, so do we normalize Trump, or do we focus on the policy agenda and whether there's any daylight between him, the self-styled head of a supposed workers' party, and the establishment that he was basically trying to give a big middle finger to, and so were his voters. I'm sort of wondering how the two come together.
Yeah, so I guess I'd lean more towards the focus on the issues and focused on how this will hurt your constituents, because not every state, obviously there's some Republican swing votes where the senator's state didn't support Donald Trump. But in a lot of cases, Donald Trump is more popular than the Republican Party. Donald Trump's more popular than Paul Ryan right now. So
And I'm sure he's certainly much more popular than Congress generally, right?
Oh,
which
yeah.
Support for Congress remain, or favorables of Congress remain like at basically Bin Laden levels
last I looked. Right. I think Castro's still outpolling them, and it's he probably got a bump this week.
I shouldn't be laughing.
Rest in peace. So I think essentially we're faced with a tough choice. No one wants to normalize him, but insofar as we can make clear that he's making really unpopular policy decisions that are even less popular than he is. And it's not – he is the least popular president-elect of all time. I'm not saying he is popular, and he also lost the popular vote. But these policies are even less popular than he is.
Well, on that note, we have an interesting couple of years, four years, last I counted, ahead of us.
Yeah,
but much to be seen. And I'm particularly interested to dig a little bit into who the nominees that Donald Trump is selecting for his cabinet are, and what they're going to be bringing to these posts. So, Jeremy Slevin, thank you so much for coming back to Talk Poverty Radio week after week to help us understand what's in the news. And next up, stay tuned for a deep dive into Trump's cabinet picks.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, Attorney General, Housing and Urban Development, Health and Human Services. It's been a bit like playing whack-a-mole the past couple of weeks, trying to keep up with President-elect Donald Trump's nominees for some of the nation's most powerful offices and the impact that these nominees could have on millions of struggling families. To look under the lid of what's at stake in the next administration, we're joined by Dorian Warren. He's the president of the Center for Community Change Action Fund, and Jared Bernstein, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks for having us.
This is an all-star studded panel we have today, if I might say so myself, but we've got serious business to do here. So I want to start with HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, because we can't not start there. Mm. And the nominee for HHS secretary is Tom Price. Jared, who is Tom Price, and what do we think this means for the programs that HHS administers?
Well, I know a little bit about Tom Price because I recently testified before the House Budget Committee, which he currently runs. He's a congressman from Georgia, I think from the Atlanta area, and an orthopedic surgeon, interestingly. And I think part of Donald Trump's thinking was Tom Price has just been a vicious critic of the Affordable Care Act. And of course, in his run for the presidency, Donald Trump talked about the disaster of Obamacare, getting rid of it, how important that was to his presidency. So in that sense, for those of us who recognize really how fundamentally well the Affordable Care Act has worked, I'm not saying that there aren't some problems, some calibration issues that need to occur, but I can take you through the argument as long as you like. This has been a very, very important addition to the fabric of American social policy. Tom Price is gunning for it big time. His appointment is really one of the more, in a cabinet that looks really pretty bad to me in a lot of ways, his is one of the really unfortunate appointments.
And Dorian, thoughts on Price?
So in addition to what Jared said, Price has a long record of wanting to advance a very conservative agenda around healthcare more broadly. So besides repealing the Affordable Care Act, he would privatize and block grant Medicare and Medicaid. He would defund Planned Parenthood, which we know provides so many crucial health services to poor and working class women around the country. So he has a long history of trying to advance a really, really harmful agenda for millions and millions of Americans when it comes to health. In addition, you know, he doesn't believe that women should have contraception. He would want to ban certain aspects of abortion. So this is actually—
Defund Planned Parenthood.
Defund Planned Parenthood. So this is— his nomination is sort of a conservative wish list that and I think it exposes the fact if we thought Trump was somehow unpredictable or wasn't aligned with the Republican Party, thus far he is proving to be, in terms of his appointments, very aligned with the modern Republican Party.
Let me reflect on a couple of those points. Very good points by Dorian. First of all, block granting Medicaid. Absolutely something Republicans have been gunning for well before Trump came on the scene. I mean, this has been a key platform of Paul Ryan, who's been the House leader now for years. And for those of our— this Talk Poverty Radio, our listeners probably know the extent to which block granting has undermined the effectiveness of TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Essentially, TANF gets the same funding it got in 1996 in nominal dollars, that it hasn't been adjusted for inflation or population growth or anything, and TANF is now basically completely unresponsive to need. Well, that's what they want to do to Medicaid. And Medicaid is obviously a critical piece of the safety net. One other point on Tom Price. I know we got a lot of people to talk to.
Well, there's a lot to say about Mr. Price.
But he's really— the thing about, say, Obamacare, it's hard to overestimate how important that victory was. And I think the defeat of Hillary Clinton, I mean, probably the first thing that came to my mind, and there were a lot of things that came rushing after that, was there goes Obamacare. Now, I don't know that that's true, but if you listen to designee Price for HHS and you listen to his ideas to replace Obamacare, they are uniformly completely ineffective in precisely the way that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is effective. So they say, well, we can by allowing people to buy health insurance across state lines, they'll be able to get affordable coverage. Well, we've tried that. It doesn't work at all. By having these health savings accounts, well, that'll work. Those work for people who have enough money such that they can save enough to pay for medical care. And I can go down the list. It's really a very serious threat.
Well, and I want to, you know, also just not lose sight of the sheer impact, the number of people, right? So we've talked a lot on this show about how the progress that's been made and because of the Affordable Care Act means that we're now at record low uninsured rates. Less than 10% of Americans now lack health insurance. But we're talking about if we actually do see Obamacare repealed and not meaningfully replaced, we're talking about potentially 22 million Americans losing their health insurance, many of whom voted for Donald Trump. And I would say weren't asking for that. Dorian?
We all know someone, a relative, a friend, a neighbor, who will be affected by the proposals that designee Price and of course, President-elect Donald Trump have put out there. So whether it's repealing Obamacare, whether it's cutting federal funding to Medicaid and block granting it to the states, privatizing Medicare, providing a voucher system for seniors to be able to get health care, which we also know doesn't work, that touches someone we know. So everyone listening, and this is millions and millions, it's far beyond the 22 million Americans who have health insurance under Obamacare. It's bigger than that. So we all will know someone, if not multiple people, who will be affected by these policies and frankly, affected for the worse. These policies and these ideas will do great harm to people. And in a sense, you know, not to be overly, not to overemphasize this, but this is life and death for so many millions of Americans in terms of our health. And it will affect all of us in a way, which the bright side of that, if there is one, is that this gives us an organizing opportunity to continue to lift up the stories of harm if any of these proposals go through and the repeal actually happens, to be lifting up these stories of harm and conveying to people, this is the role of government in either helping or hurting you. And this is the vision that the conservative movement has had for a long time they're getting to implement.
So two points to follow on there. And I know you want to get to other cabinet appointments. If you, this is radio, so we can't do PowerPoint, but let's do, let's pretend we could.
Paint us a picture, Jared.
Jared, that's actually something no one on the show has ever said before. You have actually charted
new
terrain.
Charted, I like that. Well, let me show you a chart. If you plot the share of Americans who are uninsured, okay, so these are people who don't have insurance. If you plot that line over the last 50 years, you see two periods where that line fell really sharply by 8-10 percentage points. One was when we introduced Medicare. We introduced Medicare, a lot more people got insurance, so the uninsured rate fell. And the other was when we introduced the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes way down, and then it's flat, and then it goes way down again. All right, so that's what's at risk, and Dorian is absolutely right to bring Medicare into the picture. So it's like nothing is left untouched there. The other point I wanted to make, and Dorian alluded to this, it isn't by any means 100% clear what's going to happen, right? There are definitely Republicans who are starting to say, wait a second, this is going to really whack my constituents. And in a way, I've had this thought, I'm sure I'm not the only one. It's like, well, you know, they voted 60 times to repeal Obamacare, but they knew it wasn't going to happen.
Right.
So now there's a little bit of the problem of the dog that caught the bus. You know, what are you going to do with it? So I do feel, especially with Price, I do really seriously worry that the scenario Dorian outlined will happen because there, this is where ideology takes over from politics and even political self-preservation. So it is I'm not at all saying it's not worrisome, but I do want to say we need to watch what happens and fight against.
It's gone from being a message bill to actually being governing, which means now, oh shit, like we might actually be doing this in a way that's not just politics. It's actually hurting people.
I didn't realize
people.
You could curse on
I didn't either.
Certain words. Yeah. Certain words. So we're going to, now you know.
Shit.
and we're going to take advantage of it.
Before I let you back in, Dorian, I think the other thing that is just worth saying, because you, and this is such an important point, you mentioned that it literally could be life and death for many people, and not just for low-income people. We'll be talking later in the show about what's at stake for people with disabilities under a Trump-Ryan regime, and Medicaid is a huge piece of that when it comes to people with disabilities. So more of that to come later in the segment. But Dorian, you'll have the last word on Price.
Because there are, you know, I think what the conservative agenda will be to attack Medicaid and Medicare. As we've talked about already, I've had some friends that say to me, well, remember when the Tea Party emerged in opposition to the Affordable Care Act? There were signs from at the rallies of don't get your hands off my Medicare. And so people said that to me in a hopeful way, but I'm not as hopeful. And I think this is the organizing challenge and the framing and storytelling challenge. I've already been watching interviews with Trump supporters, and reporters have asked them, well, what do you think of Trump's nominees thus far? Aren't they billionaires and alligators in the swamp? And the mental gymnastics that his supporters are going through to justify why that's a good thing, even though he ran on a populist campaign theme in some places,
and a drain
worries
the swamp
me.
Theme.
It really worries me because his supporters are, they don't see the contradiction. And so it's incumbent upon us to keep reminding people over and over and over, this is what he promised. He promised to drain the swamp. He promised to make life better for working Americans. Mm. And then he's put in his billionaire buddies and those that want to make life harmful and worse off for you.
And we'll get to some of those billionaire buddies, but now that we've declared that the price is not right, I think we can safely move on to HUD, right? Thank you. Thank you, Dorian. I'll be here for the next several minutes. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, who some folks thought might be a contender for Surgeon General because he has a background as a world-class surgeon, somehow now is the nominee to be the Secretary of Housing. Perhaps some of my favorite analysis I've seen came from a friend of mine who used to work at HUD. He said, it feels like President-elect Trump said, hi, sir, do you own a house? Oh, would you like to be Secretary of Housing? And that was the vetting that happened. Am I off base here, Jared?
I don't think so. I mean, I want to be very careful, just personally and professionally, not to get into character assassination. I want to talk about what I know about these folks' policy stances, as we did about Price.
But there's a difference between character and asking questions about experience.
Correct.
Or qualification.
Yeah. So the qualification question is incredibly germane. And, you know, we have a serious shortfall in this country of affordable housing. And when I was in the administration, was right after the housing bubble exploded, and I can't tell you how important HUD was and how much it meant having Sean, what's his last
Donovan.
Name? Sean Donovan. At all of these, at that point he ran HUD. Now he runs OMB. At those meetings, and the importance of those housing agencies under HUD remain crucial and critical today for poor families. I know if anyone's interested, the work of our housing team at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is outlining these threats in great detail. So while I can't say anything about Ben Carson in particular, I can certainly say I see no connection between any qualifications. You know, I've always said with Ben Carson, if I needed, you know, brain surgery on a on a child, which is, I think, what he did, you know, mm-hmm. he'd be my first call, but mm-hmm. pretty much that would be it.
So you're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein and Dorian Warren about the Trump cabinet picks so far. Dorian, your thoughts on Ben Carson for HUD?
Well, I don't know what there's to say. So Rebecca and Jared, I can't think of Ben Carson as the designee for HUD separate from Steve Mnuchin as the nominee for Treasury Secretary. And here's why. We know a bit about Mnuchin's record. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Mnuchin.
Thank you, Jared. As a hedge fund operator, as his work on Wall Street, but in particular, when he was chair of the board of a particular hedge fund, he was kind of called the foreclosure king because the bank that he owned was aggressive in the subprime mortgage crisis and essentially fraud in terms of signing and sort of signing statements for loans. It was one of the leaders in the state of California in foreclosures in low income communities of color and with seniors. And so the notion and basically the punchline here, he profited off of the recession and the housing crisis. It was very explicit and not shy about that. And so I can't not think of the role of HUD separate from his role at Treasury. And Jared can probably make those connections much clearer than I can. But so I kind of see those two as dual appointments in the sense that Treasury will have much more power than housing and urban development, and especially with someone whose career has been in neural surgery and not in any policy way, or especially around housing policy or affordable housing or mortgage or the mortgage industry. It just seems like HUD will actually fade in relevance. Relative to Treasury, and that's my worry here.
I think that's probably right. And let me say a word or two about that, and then maybe we could go to Mnuchin, because I do think the Treasury Secretary is so important. My experience, and I've been in this town for too many decades now, my experience is that it's exactly as Dorian suggested. Some of these agencies, under Republican leadership, they really do fade in importance. I mean, ask yourself what the Labor Department did in the Bush years. I was thinking Bush 2, but you could probably mm-hmm. think Bush 1. The only thing I can think of was they made it harder for people to get overtimes. Mm-hmm. So they kind of pushed the wrong way. You know, here's an old Washington quip that says in a Republican administration, the Labor Department becomes a branch of the Commerce Department, mm-hmm. which isn't what you want. So HUD will tend, I fear, to fade. And in that sense, maybe the best you can say is that a wholly unqualified person like Carson for that position maybe won't be able to do as much harm as somebody like Treasury Secretary designee Mnuchin. Now, one thing I will say to his credit, perhaps, is that he does have lots of financial market experience. And one of the things you have to do at the Treasury Department is oversee financial markets. But that word oversee, it actually means something. Hmm. And I heard Steve Mnuchin on TV yesterday saying what we really have to do is get rid of Dodd-Frank. In so many words, get rid of the consumer. I don't know if he said exactly that. Get rid of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and get banks lending again. Well, banks are lending. Okay, bank, there is no credit squeeze. There are some creditworthy small businesses that are having a little more trouble than they should. So I'm not saying everything's perfect by a long shot. But the credit markets are flowing. And what I heard him say was a perfect example of the kind of amnesia that just besets this town, particularly when this kind of administration comes in. Does anybody remember how the financial sector inflated a massive housing bubble that led to the greatest recession since the Great Depression, which, by the way, we're almost climbed out of 8 years later? And that
not for long, potentially.
So that kind of amnesia really worried me. He also started talking about some tax cuts that were equally worrisome, but I won't go there right now.
Well, and just back to kind of the overall theme, because, you know, Dorian, you mentioned before the commitment to draining the swamp that Trump made repeatedly on the stump and in his campaign speeches throughout the entire presidential campaign. But he actually campaigned very aggressively against kind of Wall Street financiers. And he, you know, of course, he claimed to be the self-styled head of a workers' party, but he really was saying things about Goldman Sachs and specific entities that he was equating with what he was not going to be part of and the people who were not going to be part of his administration and his Washington. So is it fair to say that just through this and other similar cabinet picks, we're already watching him break with his campaign promises? Dorian?
Oh, without question. And it's quite the opposite of draining the swamp. It's like trying to find the largest alligators possibly to bring in, right? And so I want to be careful here, like Jared. You know, it would be easy for us to say, well, look, he's appointing all these billionaires. This is going to be the richest cabinet probably in the history of the country in terms of their net worth. And what does that really mean, right? I want us to not be reactionary and just say, oh, they're billionaires running the show. But there is research that shows, there's a political scientist named Nick Carnes at Duke University who shows this in a book called, I think it's White Collar Government. There is a difference in worldview and outlook when you have someone from a poor working class background in government, whether it's elected office or appointed office, versus someone who's a millionaire, or in this case, billionaires, and the way they see the world and their interest and which populations they care most about. And so it's that substance to the critique around the billionaires that worries me, because you better believe most of these appointees will not be looking out for working class and poor people. And they will tell themselves a story that they're somehow helping. So let's be clear about that. When in fact, I worry that this will be an administration that will probably has the potential to be one of the most corrupt in the sense of crony capitalism, of helping out big banks over small community banks, of enriching in some ways those that are already connected from Wall Street and in the 1%, to use a phrase that will probably come back into favor in the next couple of years.
Jared,
so that's my worry.
You get the last word, Jared, on Mnuchin before you
okay.
move on to education.
So a couple of things. You know, I used to work for Joe Biden. Joe Biden really did come from a working class background. I'm not, neither he nor I would claim that that is his current situation at all, although he consistently was the lowest paid guy in the Senate. Yep. And he was kind of proud of that. And Joe Biden has an orientation that is exactly the opposite of what Dorian was just talking about. I don't think, from what I heard, Mnuchin isn't a billionaire. I think he's worth about $500 million, I heard. I don't know if that's at all true, but it's kind of interesting to me to picture a cabinet meeting where Mnuchin goes up to, you know, Wilbur Ross or Betsy DeVos and says, hey, you know, could I borrow a mill, you know? They all sort of like, okay, here's that.
What's
this,
a million?
What's this piker doing in here with
between
us?
Cabinet
but anyway,
secretaries.
I want to say, I actually think, I totally agree with what you intimated, Rebecca, in your swamp question and Dorian's answer to it. I completely agree with your assessment. However, and it's a strong however, I actually think that's going to prove to be a largely ineffective critique of the Trump administration. Mm. That, you know, newsflash, Donald Trump acts hypocritically. Mm-hmm. Newsflash, yeah. Donald Trump isn't keeping some of his campaign promises. Yep. He's not cleaning the swamp. He's surrounding himself with his followers, from what I can tell, aren't really looking at that and don't really care, because a lot of them didn't believe what he said in the first place. Yeah. They put him in there because they thought he could shake things up. He wasn't the establishment candidate. He talked tough. He had swagger. And then for a whole lot of other, you know, very ugly things to do with misogyny and xenophobia and racism. So,
but on that point, Jared, right? So it hypocrisy alone clearly will not be sufficient to change someone's mind about Trump, right? See the entire
presidential
election.
So then what about if he doesn't do the populist stuff?
But is that what you're... if he was popular because he wasn't the establishment guy and he was going to shake things up, and then he does the opposite and he's the establishment guy who surrounds himself with all those people.
So I know exactly what you're saying. It's a great question. And just quickly, I want to hear Dorian on this, is... I heard a guy who voted for Trump, factory worker in Florida, lost a job as a toolmaker. And here's what he said, and it kind of stuck with me. And he's one guy, but I think he's probably not the only one. I don't believe Trump's going to do a lot of what he does. I don't know that, you know, I don't really believe his populism, but I want to give him a chance. And if he doesn't, I'll vote him out. We'll try somebody else. That is, I think, the sensibility of a lot. So what Dorian said earlier, which is the critical importance of folks in our business pointing out what actually happens, is super important.
So we can't have this conversation. I'm gonna cut you off, Dorian, but bring this into the next pick. We can't have this conversation about picks without also talking about education, the education department, Betsy DeVos, and the attorney general nomination, Jeff Sessions. I want to sort of bring those into the global conversation we're having as well.
Sure.
So, Dorian, thoughts on education, and also as that I think relates to this broader theme we're talking about.
Well, you also mentioned Sessions as the attorney general pick, as well as it's not lost to me. The first person I believe President-elect Trump appointed was the former head of Breitbart News.
Oh, right.
Steve Bannon. To be a chief strategist.
And so when you put in my head, when I put together Bannon and Sessions, who aren't dog whistle racially coded. They don't use racially coded dog whistles. They're very explicit and have a track record and a public track record of promoting racial division and being anti-civil rights and anti-racial justice. That deeply worries me in terms of the notion that somehow advancing civil rights or racial justice is antithetical to the interest of all Americans or white Americans, in fact. And so that was an early signal to me, considering those are the first two appointments or two of the first appointments, that President Trump was serious, that it wasn't just a campaign strategy to use racially coded words and dog whistles and, in fact, dog barking, but that there's an agenda and a long-term agenda to roll back the civil rights gains of the 60s with his administration. And so, it's again, to go back to the hypocrisy part, it's one thing to point out the hypocrisy. He says that, you know, the blacks love him and the Latinos love him. Well, that wasn't the case in the voting behavior of those populations, and it certainly won't be the case in terms of the actual real conditions when it comes to, can someone rent an apartment or can someone get a job, and the fight against discrimination that is ongoing. So that I couldn't escape mentioning those two in particular, Rebecca, because they're deeply troublesome to those of us in the fight for racial justice and civil rights.
And designee Sessions, of course, being someone who has called the Voting Rights Act a piece of intrusive legislation. Also someone who was rejected from a federal judgeship back in the 80s because a bipartisan Senate panel found out through delving through his record that he had called the NAACP communist-inspired and un-American, and that he had actually accused the organization's then-lead civil rights attorney, who was white, a, quote, traitor to his race, just to underscore
your
point,
so
Jared.
To me, this is... as if not more worrisome than the price discussion we had earlier and the cutting off Obamacare at the knees. And the reason is, for everything the two of you just said, but it's not that these guys are coming out of nowhere. You see, they're catching a wave. And that's what's, I think, particularly scary about this, is there is obviously an insurgent movement to push back the very gains you're talking about. Let me move to Betsy DeVos. How do you say her name, DeVos?
I think it's DeVos.
DeVos, Betsy DeVos. So there are three types of people, three different ways of thinking of the charter debate, which is where I think what she's doing there. That's why she was brought in. One is people who are just completely against charters and think anytime you're fooling around with the charters, you're screwing the public schools, you shouldn't do it. I don't count myself in that camp. There's a middle group that says, in fact, there are failing public schools, and far be it from me to tell a parent who has to send their kid to a failing public school, no, you have to do that. It's good public policy. I won't do that. I don't think anyone should. There should be options. But And this is key to the second group, and here's the distinction between the both. What you really want to do is learn what the charters can teach you, and they can teach you some important things. Not all of them, by the way, are doing great by a long measure. On average, their performance outcomes are much like the traditional public schools. But there are some that are doing great stuff. You've got to take what they're doing, learn from it, bring that back to the publics. And so your investment in the charter movement has to be one that doesn't undermine and screw the traditional public schools. And then there's this third category, and that's where DeVos is. She wants to use the charter movement as a cudgel, as a club, to bash traditional public schools and teachers' unions. And that's very dangerous.
Dorian.
Jared said it all. You know, the only other thing I would add with her is, Jared, actually, that was a great framework to be thinking of the role of charters. And there are multiple camps. I would place her also in the camp of using public school dollars to fund for-profit charters, to siphon off public dollars for for-profit charter schools, which I think I'm all for charter schools in a nonprofit sense and where we can learn how to improve the overall system.
Sort of as laboratories.
As laboratories of experimentation. But there is something distasteful about channeling public money to for-profit charter operators who, by the way, have very low performance records. That seems to me to contradict the stated goals of the charter school movement overall. And then secondly, the other thing to say about her is her long-term opposition to marriage equality to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people in this country. She believes in something called conversion therapy, which frankly just doesn't recognize the full humanity and freedom of people to say who they are and be who they are.
And you should explain what conversion therapy is.
Conversion therapy is this notion that if you're gay or if you're somehow, if you're queer in some way, that if you go through usually a very evangelical Christian process combined with some non-scientific forms of psychotherapy, that you can become straight, right? You're being converted from not straight to straight in some way.
Well, we've got a lot to watch in the coming weeks and months, including hearings on all of these folks. But I can't thank you guys enough for joining Talk Poverty Radio to explore and dredge through the swamp. Jared Bernstein is the senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He's also the former chief economist to Vice President Joe Biden. And Dorian Warren is the president of the Center for Community Change Action Fund. Both are, I hope, going to be back on the show soon as we see where we go from here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission. Because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. There's been no shortage of discussion of what a Trump presidency means for immigrants, for women, and communities of color. But one group of Americans who are among the most at risk haven't been talked about almost at all. People with disabilities. Here to discuss what Trump's policies will mean for the 1 in 5 Americans with disabilities in the United States is Ari Nehman. He's the president of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and he served as one of President Obama's appointees to the National Council on Disability from 2010 to 2015. Ari, it's great to have you on the show, finally.
Well, thank you for having me, Rebecca. It's a difficult time, but it's all the more important that we communicate to the public the risk people with disabilities face.
Well, and just to get right down to it, you wrote a piece for Vox, and it was titled, "I'm a Disabled American. Trump's Policies Will Be a Disaster for People Like Me." I think under other circumstances, I might accuse you of being a little bit histrionic, but I don't think that's the case here.
That's absolutely right. What we have to understand is that people with disabilities have a tremendously important relationship with the very programs that the Trump administration, the incoming Trump administration, has promised to utterly decimate over the next 4 years. Medicaid, which finances in excess of 80% of developmental disability services for autistic adults, for people with Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, people with intellectual disabilities, is now under threat of a $1 trillion cut in funding over the next 10 years via the Medicaid block granting proposal. The Affordable Care Act, which, as we all know, completed the work of the ADA in extending non-discrimination protections in the world of health insurance by ending pre-existing condition discrimination, is also under threat. I think one thing that hasn't been discussed as much is the degree to which Donald Trump, as an individual, and the sort of coterie of people that surround him are often actively hostile to the disability rights movement and to mainstream thinking on disability advocacy. You know, only a few months before the election in August, Trump met with Andrew Wakefield, the discredited British physician who was largely responsible for popularizing the now since disproved link between autism and vaccines. And of course, as we know, Trump repeated that discredited premise in a Republican primary debate. So we're talking about not only an administration that is threatening to drastically slash the funding, services and supports, legal enforcement that people with disabilities depend on, but also one that frankly has ideas that are radically out of the advocacy community and the scientific community's mainstream about the nature of disability itself.
Well, and backing up, because you started with Medicaid, and I think that's probably exactly where we need to start, given the dire nature of the threats that that program is facing, both in conjunction with potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but also just generally if Medicaid itself were to be massively slashed, either by converting it into a block grant or a kind of a technical term, per capita caps, but it's just another word for cut. But help us understand, why is Medicaid so important, not just for people generally who need health insurance, but for people with disabilities?
So Medicaid is popularly looked at as just a health insurance program for low-income Americans. And that's important enough. And many people with disabilities depend on Medicaid solely for that role. But in fact, Medicaid is also the primary financer of long-term services and supports. So that's everything from home care to help keep a person with a disability or a senior citizen in their own home, in less optimal situations, nursing home care, more optimal situations, job coaches for young people with developmental disabilities, essentially the broad scope of what we would consider disability and aging services, the vast majority of it is paid for by Medicaid. And what most people don't understand is that this is actually a very sizable percentage of what Medicaid does. This is not some small aspect of the Medicaid program that can be put to the side as funding for the program as a whole is drastically slashed. The 6% of Medicaid beneficiaries who receive long-term services and supports make up 43% of Medicaid program costs. You know, the conservative argument that all we need to do is get rid of fraud, waste, and abuse, and then we can cut these programs as much as we like with no negative consequences to people with disabilities, is just simply not true. That's not what the math is showing us.
So now taking that and taking it to the next level, right? If we really are facing repeal and there's this hypothetical theoretical replacement of the Affordable Care Act, but we haven't yet seen anything from Republicans when it comes to what they would actually replace it with. So we really are looking at the potential for a GOP-controlled government headed by a Trump administration to repeal the Affordable Care Act. A big piece of that law was the legal protection for people with pre-existing conditions. How would that play out for people with disabilities?
Well, very negatively. And I think one of the things you have to understand is that that's not just the health insurance conversation. It's also a conversation around employment. People with disabilities often enter the two major disability insurance programs, Social Security Disability Insurance and Supplemental Security Income, in order to access the public insurance programs of Medicare and Medicaid, specifically because, up until very recently, the commercial insurance market discriminated against people with disabilities, would not provide people with disabilities with health insurance, or would do so at a substantial cost, a substantial premium in cost. And if we see a return to pre-existing condition discrimination, we're going to see a sizable risk that people with disabilities who have been able to enter the labor market are no longer going to be able to do so because of a loss of necessary services due to a loss of insurance, or because of needing to return to income support programs in order to be able to qualify for public insurance that does not come with pre-existing condition discrimination. So it's a question of loss of insurance coverage and loss of healthcare services, but it's also a potential major blow to the disability employment efforts that have historically been part of the bipartisan consensus on disability.
Now, you end your piece, which up until this point is sort of a lot of doom and gloom, and justifiably so because of the threats that we are facing under a Trump administration. And I should also note a Paul Ryan regime as well, given his role in all of this.
We can't give him a pass.
No. He's, you know, in many ways the architect, as this show often discusses, of the policies that now we're seeing backed by Trump. But you end on a much more optimistic note than one might have expected to have coming, given the doom and gloom leading up to that point. And that's you make two critical points, and I want to hear you discuss both of them. But you first argue that, you know what, this isn't the first time that we've seen massive threats to critical investments and programs and policies for people with disabilities. And actually, disability activists have faced down those attempts to roll back disability rights multiple times in the past, and they've won. And you tell that story, I think, in a very important way. You also argue that in some ways, while the Trump presidency, your words, will be a disaster for people with disabilities, that sometimes disasters can also present opportunities. So I want to first ask you to tell a little bit of the story of how activism has beaten back these kinds of threats before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one thing that is important to remember is the history of where disability came under threat in prior administrations. So if we go back to the early Reagan administration, the Reagan folks come in, and one of their first goals is to roll back federal special education law. In 1975, Congress had passed what was then called the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, is now called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, guaranteeing children with disabilities the right to a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. It's actually the legislation that Trump's Attorney General nominee, Jeff Sessions, was extremely disdainful of in 2000 on a speech on the Senate floor. But Reagan moved quickly to try and repeal that, initially in Congress. And when that failed, he attempted to gut the law through the regulatory process. The disability rights community managed to mobilize en masse, sending over 40,000 letters, postcards, messages to the White House. Remember, this was in a time before email, when 40,000 postcards was something you could do the backstroke in. And the Reagan administration backed off. We saw a very similar dynamic, admittedly with far more collateral damage, when the Reagan administration moved to remove hundreds of thousands of people with disabilities from the critical Social Security Disability Insurance Program. Eventually, in subsequent litigation and action by Congress, I believe the majority of folks removed from the rolls were restored. And so we know that when we mobilize, we can win, we can succeed. So the name of the game over the course of the next 4 years is going to be to mobilize the disability community and place particular emphasis on many of the prominent legislators, some of them Republicans, who have expressed a commitment to the disability community in the past and maybe have been willing to take votes to block grant Medicaid or repeal the ACA when they knew that President Obama was going to save them from the consequences of their actions by vetoing that. They need to hear from the disability community that nobody's going to save them from the consequences of their actions now. You cannot pretend to be a friend to the disability rights community and also propose to slash hundreds of billions of dollars from the programs we depend on. It's just not possible. So the major emphasis of disability rights advocacy over the next 4 years is going to be to organize that pushback and focus with razor-sharp precision on ensuring that the legislators who have made rhetorical commitments to the disability community understand that they're not going to be able to maintain that perception of friendship while taking these votes.
Now, that's a fantastic segue into the sort of note that you close on of this opportunity in disaster. I think anyone who was not living under a rock throughout this presidential cycle remembers and has seen dozens of times in campaign commercials, in all sorts of mediums, Donald Trump mocking a reporter with a disability. And so in addition to all of the threats that you've laid out, as well as the setting autism policy back potentially by, you know, a decade or more through his revival of long disabused myths. He's also incredibly disrespectful. He's derisive, but there's potentially opportunity there. How do you see that being a path to opportunity?
So, you know, one thing I think it's important to recall is that when we see a community come under attack, there is the chance to really organize a pushback that can be propagated throughout the progressive movement. We saw it to some degree in the pushback against the Bush administration's attack on LGBTQ Americans with their use of the then specter of gay marriage as a get-out-the-vote tactic in 2004. In part as a result of that and as a result of the efforts of activists from that community, LGBTQ rights became far more mainstreamed within the progressive coalition than they had been in the past. We have a similar opportunity when it comes to disability. Disability rights advocates have historically been instinctively bipartisan. And that's understandable. It's at least partially a function of the fact that we've been able to secure bipartisan support in a way that other civil rights communities have not always been able to do so. But because of the specter of Trump, we have a chance now to work much more collaboratively with other communities under threat and to work to ensure that our priorities And disability rights concerns around cuts to services, around returning people to institutions and nursing homes who had been supported with home and community-based services in the community, become part of the talking points used by the broader progressive community in pushing back against Trump. There's a chance to make our issues their issues as well. The discussion about Trump mocking a disabled reporter, you know, in some ways it's a proto version of what we're talking about. But the question is, can we get all of these folks who are talking about the fact, or who were talking about the fact that Donald Trump is a bully, to also start talking about the very specific and real policy threats that the Trump administration poses to disability rights? It's not enough to say Donald Trump is mean to people with disabilities. He is. He is a bully. But we have to take it a step further and bring the progressive community along to start talking about the programs, laws, and rights that are under threat and that people with disabilities depend on, that we need to defend under a Trump administration.
I've been speaking with Ari Nehman. He's the president of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network and also served as one of President Obama's appointees to the National Council on Disability. Ari, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio. And I'm terrified for what lies ahead, but I appreciate your words of optimism, and I look forward to working with you in this fight.
Solidarity, Rebecca. Thank you for having me on the program.
And I look forward to having you back soon. And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes. And send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford, cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working, trying to bring in the...